So how do you follow that clip? What you've seen there is a story collision of what I'm going to call master stories. There are many collisions in life, from politics to marriage, and I think many of those collisions are collisions of master stories, but that's something we're going to explore as we go on. Let me simply say at this point, we all have master stories to live, and the purpose of life is to be the kind of character we were created to be in the greatest story ever told. So that's a preview of things to come over the next hour. I want to start more simply than that. And since I don't want to be the only voice heard over the next hour, I'd like to ask you to do me a favor and repeat the following after me. Once upon a time, let me tell you a story. Now in those days, a decree went out from Caesar Augustus. Call me Ishmael. There once was a man in the land of Uz whose name was, can you finish it? Job. Let us go then, you and I. That's for the English majors in the crowd. Long, long ago. What's the next line? Far. Very good. There came a man sent from God whose name was John. Once there was a tree, and she loved, how's that one finished? A little boy. Jesus said a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho and fell among robbers. I sort of taxed your memory there, didn't I? In the great green room, I'll break this one up for you. There was a telephone and a red balloon and a picture of, how's that one end? Wonderful. The cow jumping over the moon. We could go on, couldn't we? No, don't say that. There is a point to all of this. Human beings are story-shaped creatures. Human beings are story-shaped creatures. We're born into stories. We are raised in stories. We answer all of life's big questions by stories. Who am I? Where did I come from? What am I here for? What is going to happen to me when I die? And it is the hope and confidence of every believer that when we do die, we live in a story forever. One that stretches from eternity past to eternity future and tells us what to do in eternity present. The storied nature of our lives has many implications, and I want to talk today about just a few of them. But because I'm an English teacher, I believe in putting my thesis sentence right up there in the beginning. So this is the thesis that I'm going to try to explain and defend in the next hour. The single best way of conceiving of faith and the life of faith is as a story in which you are a character. The single best way of conceiving of faith and the life of faith is a story in which you are a character. Your task is to be a character in the greatest story ever told. That's what you were created for. If you want to know why you're here, that is one way of expressing the answer to that. Why do I say that, and what are some of the implications if that's true? Why do I say that one of the best way to think of faith is as a story in which you are a character? In the spirit of John Piper's preaching, I'm going to give you 12 reasons why I think this is true. Now, I'm not a member of John's church, Bethlehem Baptist, but I've heard John many times over the years, and I know that he believes that three-point sermons are for wimps. I've also learned not to be surprised if he reads a half a verse from Leviticus and says, there are 32 things in this half verse that teach us about the character of God. And it's going to take us 42 weeks to get through them. And I want to say, John, there's only 8 words here. but he always finds meat. So I only have 12 things to say, but I also only have an hour, so I'm going to move more rapidly maybe than is effective, but I just have this burden to get through all 12. Point number one, the best way to think of faith is as a story in which I am a character, because stories are God's idea. Stories are God's idea. God is the one who created stories and the form of story, and us as creatures of story. God created us as story creatures, and story is the way that God has chosen to present himself to us in the Bible. God is telling the world a story. It's how I think of what God is doing. He is telling us a story. He's unwinding this amazing narrative. It begins in eternity past. It stretches into eternity future. It climaxed 2,000 years ago when God entered into his creation in a new way. It could reach its temporal end today or in 5,000 years. The theme of the story, all stories have themes, is shalom. Shalom is all things in their created place doing what they were created to do in loving relationship with their creator. That is the theme of the great story that God is telling us. And miracle beyond miracle, it is a story into which God invites you and me as characters. That is part of the good news. That is part of the gospel. Here is this amazing story. It is the story of all creation, and you are invited to be a character. If faith were an idea, the intellect alone might be adequate for dealing with it. Since it is instead a life to be lived, we need story. If faith was just something to agree to, your mind can make a decision whether to agree to it or not. But faith is so much more than that. It is a life to be lived out, and that's why we need story. It is no surprise, then, that the central record of faith in human history opens with an unmistakable story signature in the beginning. That just says right from the beginning, right from the start, story in the beginning. What in the beginning? We want to know. And of course, even more important than in the beginning is the next word, in the beginning, God. This is the opening scene of the great story of scriptures, in which we will find our own story. Why story? Well, let me tell you one. My earliest memory of movies were formed in drive-in theaters. Drive-in theaters are a form of entertainment that has gone the way of the phonograph and the 8-track cassette player. You still might find one. If you find one, buy it. It was at a drive-in theater in the 1950s in Santa Barbara, California, out by the airport, that I first witnessed the parting of the Red Sea. And don't think you understand the parting of the Red Sea until you've seen it on a huge outdoor screen through your car windshield, with a bucket of butter-wet popcorn in your hands, through the eyes of a 9-year-old boy. Charlton Heston stood up by that rock, and the Weasley, Edward G. Robinson, was there saying, "Oh, the Egyptians are coming. You know? And he said something about the power of God, which I didn't quite catch, but he raised his staff, and the waters bubbled for a while, and then they went up on both sides, forming these huge walls. And there was a path right through the water, and the whole nation of Israel went down through that path. It was enough to stop me chewing on my popcorn and start me chewing on the idea that God was God, and that what God wanted to do things, he could do eye-popping things. Now, compare that experience with presenting a 9-year-old boy with the following proposition: God is powerful. Certainly that's true. It's nothing I would disagree with as a 9-year-old. It's certainly nothing I would disagree with now. But it's also nothing that would make me stop chewing my popcorn. God is powerful.
Okay, you say, but I'm not a 9-year-old
boy. And Charlton Heston talks like a robot the whole movie. And the special effects are really bad. If you want to prove that God exists, you say, you're going to have to do a lot better than that. Prove that God exists? I don't want to prove that God exists. God exists or doesn't exist apart from my proving or anyone's proving or disproving. A handful of people in life are called perhaps to try to prove that God exists. The rest of us are simply trying to figure out how to live. And what I'm claiming is that the best way to live is to find your place in God's great story of his love for his creation. Which, by the way, is also, I think, the best way of proving that God exists. Now, if that seems too anti-intellectual to you, let me remind you that understanding stories involves the intellect. It is just that it involves more than the intellect. It helps to bring intelligence to the story experience, but also bring your emotions and intuitions and imagination, and yes, even your body. When I saw those waters part, I felt it in my stomach, as well as in my brain. You know, I caught my breath, my pulse quickened, even the body was part of believing what I was seeing. I wasn't just seeing something, much less thinking about something. I was experiencing something. I was, for those moments, in the middle of the story, in the middle of the sea, with those frightened Jews, and I was experiencing a miracle. And it was literally awesome. It's now quite a few years and a few educational degrees later. I can reason as carefully as the next fellow. I understand the value of propositions and evidence, but I still think we have to start with the stories. The Bible doesn't simply contain stories. The Bible reflects God's choice of the form of the story as the primary means by which to tell us about himself and how to be in right relationship with him, and of how to preserve that knowledge over many, many generations. Think about, for instance, a second great crossing of water by the people of Israel. This is about 40 years or so after Charlton Heston got across. This is the story of the crossing of the Jordan into the Promised Land. Moses has died. The nation of Israel is now under the leadership of Joshua, and it's time to cross into the Promised Land. And by the way, what is a leader? A leader is a keeper of a story. A keeper, a preserver, and an extender of a story. That's what a leader is. But that's another talk. But they arrived at the Jordan River ready to claim the promise that God had given them and found that the Jordan was at flood stage. It was flowing fast and it was much too wide and there was no way they were going to get across. What happens in the story? God tells Joshua to have the priests carrying the Ark of the Covenant to step into the river. And when they do, the river stops flowing and they stand in the middle of the river and the whole nation of Israel crosses. And then God has Joshua do an interesting thing. He tells him to appoint one member from each of the 12 tribes and to have that representative of the tribe go back into the middle of the river where the covenant, the Ark of the Covenant is standing, and each of them to pick up a stone. And then listen to what he says. This is Joshua 4:4 and following. So Joshua called together the 12 men he had appointed from the Israelites, one from each tribe, and said to them, go over before the ark of the Lord your God into the middle of the Jordan. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of the tribes of the Israelites, to serve as a sign among you. That's a key phrase. To serve as a sign among you. In the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the ark of the covenant of the Lord. When it crossed the Jordan, the waters of the Jordan were cut off. These stones, listen to this, these stones are to be a memorial to the people of Israel forever. This is a passage about the importance of memory and about the importance of telling stories. The nation of Israel had problems with memory lapses. The prophets were sent to them basically as storytellers to remind them of the stories of the past, knowing that knowing the stories of the past are the key to the present and to the future. Joel 1:3 says, regarding the amazing things God has done for them, tell it to your children, and let your children tell it to their children, and their children to the next generation. When the nation of Israel remembered the stories that told them who they were, they flourished. They knew where they had come from. They knew who they were. When they quit telling the stories or forgot the stories, they no longer understood who they were, and they invited disaster. This is why Joshua says, one person from each tribe, go back into the river, take a stone, and build a monument on the other side. That pile of rocks is a story prompt. It is there to elicit future storytelling. The rock monument in their midst will cause the children of the next generation to ask, why are those rocks there? What's that about? And that question will prompt the story, and a new generation will understand the power of God. This story in Joshua ends with these words: he did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful, and so that you might always fear the Lord your God. The Lord is powerful. That's a proposition. It's a statement of fact. It is true. But by itself, it doesn't have a lot of impact. How do we know the Lord is powerful? Let me tell you a story. What does it mean to say the Lord is powerful? Let me tell you a story. A story about the time the nation of Israel crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land. A story about the time Gideon routed the enemies of God with a handful of men. A story about Jesus raising Jairus' daughter from the dead. The story about the empty tomb. Propositions are important. The Lord is powerful. The Lord is good. Jesus is the Son of God. Christ did rise from the dead. But propositions depend on the stories out of which they arise for their power and meaning and practical application. The propositions depend on the stories out of which they arise for all those things. Imagine having all the propositions of faith, but none of the stories. No Genesis, no Exodus, none of the history books of the Old Testament, no Gospel, no Acts, only Romans. And we could do a 12-year series on Romans, we know that. And scattered assertions and commands here and there from here and there in Scripture. That's all we have, are these statements, true statements, but unadorned statements. These propositions would be true, are true, but we would have very little idea what to do with them. Propositions are the shorthand for stories. I don't know if that's the best metaphor, but it's the one that comes to mind. Propositions are the shorthand for the stories. When we try to explain something or to correct something or to understand something, we often cannot take the time to tell all the relevant stories. So instead, we use propositions. The short, hopefully clear, assertion. The proposition stands in for the stories, but the propositions also depend on the stories for their ultimate significance. I would be clear here, and I would be understood, because I know I'm in a room full of people who love propositions. And this is a clean shirt. I wouldn't want tar or feather on it. God does not ask, and the Bible does not ask, us to choose between propositions and stories. We are provided both. Stories and propositions need each other. Each provides a kind of check or a limit on the other. The propositional truth acts as a check on how we interpret a story. Stories do not just mean anything you want them to mean. And propositions help us understand that. And story is a check on propositions. Story offers the richness and the specificity and the motivation necessary to keep the propositions from being merely abstract, reductionist, inert, shallow, or legalistic. So we need them both. We need propositions. We need story. But my warning is this: never let the propositions and your belief in them get very far from the stories. and most, you know, equally important, your own participation as a character in that story. Don't let those propositions sort of become the whole story. Keep those propositions and those stories close together. The Joshua story also demonstrates the Bible's understanding that stories are the best way of instructing the next generation. It is always telling people to remember. And usually when in Scripture, when you're told to remember something, the thing you're supposed to remember is a story. Often the story of God's provision for his people. Look at Psalm 102. The psalmist reviews and celebrates the faithfulness of God to those who obey him. Then it makes a very interesting declaration in verse 18. It says, "Let this be written for a future generation, that a people not yet created may praise the Lord." Let this be written for a future generation, that a people not yet created may praise the Lord. Well, who is this future generation? It is, among other people, you and me. How is it you have the opportunity to know the God who created you? Because someone told the story. And someone else wrote down the story. And others chose to repeat the story. And some people died for the story. And so generation after generation, the story of God's love for his creation has been told. And we are the beneficiaries, which of course raises a question. Stories are never more than a generation away from extinction. Every time you drive by a rest home, which is one of the more ridiculous euphemisms in our culture, those people in there aren't resting, by the way. Think of all the stories that are dying every day, unrecorded, never to be preserved or to be passed on. If we don't tell the stories, if we don't encapsulate experience somehow in a story form that's passed on, it will disappear. So the question to us, are we going to be the first generation who does not pass on the story of faith? Right? We got the benefit because for many generations people have sacrificed for the story. And of course, it's our job to pass it on as well. So that's my first point. And then the other ones are going to come faster. Don't worry about it. Stories are God's idea. Second point, we do well to think of faith as a story in which we participate because it fits how we have been made and how we live. It fits how we have been made and how we live. Human beings are biologically made to be storytellers and story listeners. The brain, your brain is constantly flooded with data. It could easily be overwhelmed. The only way for the brain to survive with any kind of coherence is to find organizing principles for packaging that data in one way or another. And the way the brain does this best is through stories. It puts our experience into story form, which is a way we both can understand the world and we both also can remember our own experiences. So the brain is always looking for this narrative thread. God made the brain that way. And God gave us stories to help us remember the things we need to remember, such as the power of God in bringing his people into the promised land. We're also made for stories because we're social creatures. We're made to be in relationship with God, with the creation, with other human beings. The single most common and powerful way we relate to each other is through telling each other stories. You know, it's afternoon. You have already told many stories today. You've run into people you haven't seen for a while. You say, "How's it going?" And that's a story prompt. Tell me stories. When the ubiquitous question when someone comes home from work by the person they're sharing their life with is, "How did it go today?" or "How was your day?" I assure you, the person who asks that question does not want a one-word answer. Fine. They want stories. It can be trivial, seemingly trivial stories, little glimpses of stories. But stories, telling each other stories, is the single best way we have of sharing our experience with people that we care about, including God. God has used that method to have a relationship with us. We tell our stories back to God in prayer, in worship, in preaching, in all kinds of different ways. Third, we do well to think of faith in story terms because, like faith, stories engage us as whole persons, not as parts. Stories engage us as whole persons, not as parts. No one believes anything important with the intellect alone. Let me say that again for you rationalists out there. No one believes anything important with the intellect alone. Believing is a whole body, whole life experience. If it isn't, it's not belief. It's simply agreement with an idea. And agreement with an idea is not what faith is all about. Believing enlists all the aspects of the mind, including the intellect, analysis, intuition, memory, curiosity, imagination. How often do you find anybody preaching on the benefits of curiosity or of imagination? It also engages the emotions, including our desires, affections, and fears. And believing also involves the will, including intention, purpose, resolve, motivation, and perseverance. How and what we believe is also influenced by personality and temperament and character, and yes, by the body. And of course, all of these things, the minds, emotions, and will, are deeply influenced by the stories of our life experience. So you don't believe anything deeply that isn't a product of all that you are, not just some little part of your mind. So our beliefs about God, right and wrong, life and death, and endless specific issues such as abortion, terrorism, race, presidential candidates, immigration, the role of women, homosexuality, and so on, cannot be separated from thousands of life experiences, conscious and unconscious, subtle and overt, and we capture these experiences in stories. We think oftentimes we believe something because it's been revealed or because it's clearly logical, but if you really look at why you believe many things, it's a whole complex of stories. How obtuse, then, to think that we arrive or even should arrive at our important beliefs through any single faculty, least of all through leaky reason. I'm not an irrationalist. Reason is a powerful God-given tool, but it is a tool that will serve any master, including the most odious. People will use, you know, reasonableness to defend horrific things. So reason by itself does not get us to where we need to go. We need to reason as carefully and as well as we can, but we're foolish to think that any single mental faculty or human faculty alone can tell us what isn't true, what is important, what to believe, how to live. So don't organize your life around anything that values only one aspect of what you are. I think a lot of heresies and false teachings and just stupid things in life arise from not treating us as whole people, and bad church experiences, you know, not being treated as entire people. We appeal to one little part of ourselves, and we think that's enough, and that is not the case, and stories don't do that. So anything that respects only the reason is inadequate. If it appeals only to the emotions, it will let you down. If it only values willpower and discipline, it will crack and crumble. You and I need a story to live by that takes seriously every aspect of what we are as created beings. If you want some evidence that stories involve us as whole persons, or that the use of story is central in the Bible, consider the story of David, Bathsheba, and the prophet Nathan. This is an example, you know, of one of hundreds of examples from within the Bible of how stories shape us and how the Bible sees that as the case. This one is told in 2 Samuel chapters 11 and 12. And as in so many stories, context is crucial. David has abused his power in order to sleep with Bathsheba and has made her pregnant. To cover his failure morally and as a leader, he has her husband called back from the wars, assuming that Uriah, of course, will sleep with his wife and therefore cover David's sin. David, however, has not counted on Uriah's integrity and loyalty. Amazingly, he bumps into a guy who has high character, and it ruins his plan. When Uriah refuses the comforts of home while his fellow soldiers have none, David resorts to arranging for his death and brings Bathsheba into his household. This is a powerful story in itself, and you could spend, you know, many hours unpacking it and all the stories, all the lessons for us that are in it. And yet there's another story within this story, and I love stories within a story. It's sort of story squared or something like that. And this story within a story signals a change in the direction of David's life and in the whole nation of Israel. And it's the story of Nathan, because God sends Nathan to David, and Nathan tells him a story. It's a trap. No, it's not really a trap. It's an instrument of revelation. God wants David to learn something, and he doesn't tell him with a straight proposition, although he'll get to some later on. He tells it to him with a story. And Nathan tells it masterfully, with a storyteller's sense of timing and irony and pathos. Listen to Nathan's words from 2 Samuel 12. Then the Lord sent Nathan to David, and he came to him and said, "There were two men in a certain town, the one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a great many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb, which he bought and nourished, and it grew up together with him and his children. He would eat of his bread; it would eat of his bread and drink of his cup and lie in his bosom, and was like a daughter to him. Now a traveler came to the rich man, and he was unwilling to take from his flock or from his own herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. Rather, he took the poor man's ewe lamb and prepared it for the man who had come." Nathan's story has this sort of once upon a time feel to it, this feel of fiction. There were two men in a certain town. A lot of stories start that way. I think it sounds more like that than it does like an accounting of an actual historical event, although it's not particularly relevant. And yet, David is totally engaged in this story. David doesn't care whether it's fiction or not. It's a story. Stories do not have to have happened to be true. Maybe that sounds like an English teacher. And if you think that's heretical, you should realize all English teachers are heretical. So, you know, we get a free pass. You know, go to the pearly gates, God says, heretic, but he's an English teacher, let him in. Because we don't know any better. Stories do not need to have happened to be true. So David is enraged by the actions of the rich man in Nathan's story and proclaims in all his royal indignation, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this deserves to die." The man who did this deserves to die. All of David is engaged in this story. His intellect, his sense of justice, his emotions, and yes, his body. His heart is beating faster because of this story. He responds to Nathan's story as a whole person. Not just as, "Oh, that's an interesting moral situation you've created there." It's everything. That story has grabbed all parts of him. And this is exactly the response that Nathan must have hoped for. At this climactic moment, Nathan unleashes the lightning bolt of revelation as only a great story can. We can picture him reaching out his arms and pointing at David as he shouts, "You are that man. You are that man." Nathan then makes explicit the connection between the story he's told and David's story. A connection David hadn't seen coming. David is the rich man, and Uriah the poor man. David has been given much, and yet has taken from the man who had little. David has been blessed by God, and he has responded by breaking God's law. This story about David and Nathan shows not only that God uses stories, and that we are wired to make and respond to stories, and that stories affect us as whole persons. It also makes some other important points I want to claim about the relationship between stories and faith. And this is my fourth point. Stories are about choices and their consequences, and so is the life of faith. Stories are about choices and their consequences, and so is the life of faith. The essence of story is people making choices. and especially characters making difficult choices with uncertain outcomes. It is what draws us to story. I think in part because we feel we're in that position too, and we're looking for clues, for help. So that tension, that heart tension of hard choices is at the heart of story. What is she going to do with that gun? What's behind that door? Is she strong enough to resist marrying that jerk? You know, why is he so obsessed with killing a white whale? You know, these kinds of things. And there always is the implicit question, I think, when a story has engaged us, and especially that focuses on hard choices, is what would I do if I was in that situation? What if that was me? What if that was my story? In the Bathsheba story, David made disastrous choices, and they had disastrous consequences. A woman abused, a faithful subject murdered, a baby dead, the character of the king compromised, and therefore the community put at risk. Nathan tells him because of his sin, Israel will never know peace in his lifetime. Everybody suffers because of his bad choices in this story. All because David wasn't satisfied with everything God had given him. He wanted more. He wanted something else. He wanted a different story than the one God had for him. But this story also indicates another quality of story. Fifth, stories have the power to change us. Stories have the power to change us. And what is faith about if it isn't about changed lives? Right? So if you want to change lives, story is the vehicle for doing this. David's failure and its consequences are revealed by his story, but it also should be pointed out that Nathan's story also led David to repent. David is shown his story within Nathan's story. And unlike his predecessor Saul, he reacts appropriately. This is the great quality of David. He's one of the biggest sinners in the Bible. But when his sin was pointed out to him, he knew how to confess, and he knew that he should confess, and he confessed sincerely. He says, "I have sinned against the Lord." And that confession spares his life. But it doesn't erase all the consequences of his choices. It doesn't save him and Bathsheba from the loss of their son. But it does make possible, because he does not die, the subsequent birth of Solomon, the son who will carry on his line. Powerful stories have this potential to change us. They do not exist to kill time. Worst possible reason to read a story. You know, these summer novels. Don't read it to kill time. Time is a thing, one of the most precious things you have. And stories which just are killing time are killing you. Right? So stories are not to kill time. Stories are to redeem the time. And look for stories that redeem the time. And I think in this sense, stories are quite aggressive. An important story says you must be different because of what you have heard. You cannot hear this story. And I would go further. You cannot experience this story and still be exactly the same person that you were before this. David could not hear Nathan's story. And Nathan's interpretation of the story and application of the story to his own life, and pretend that he could just go about his normal business. He was a king, but kings have to pay heed to stories too. And the same, of course, is true of the gospel story, and more, even more true. Once you have heard that story, you are not allowed to remain the same. You are not allowed to remain the same once you have heard the gospel stories. And great stories will not let us stay the same. They say you must be other than you are. Which leads to my sixth point. Stories are directive. Stories are directive. They tell us we must change, and they often tell us how we must change. Stories teach us our lines. Listen to this. This is from a contemporary philosopher and ethicist named Alistair MacIntyre. He says, I can only answer the question, what am I to do in life, if I can answer the prior question of what story or stories do I find myself apart? It is through hearing stories about wicked stepmothers, lost children, good but misguided kings, and eldest sons who waste their inheritance, on riotous living and go into exile to live with the swine, that children learn or mislearn both what a child and what a parent is, what the cast of characters may be in the drama into which they have been born and what the ways of the world are. And he makes a very interesting assertion. Deprive children of stories and you leave them unscripted, anxious stutterers in their actions as in their words. Deprive children of stories and you leave them unscripted, anxious stutterers in their actions as in their words. If people today, young or old, seem to have no direction or to be inarticulate about their lives, it is in large part because they've been starved of good stories. They don't know how to behave. They literally don't know what to say. They don't know their lines. Stories change us. Stories direct us. Stories teach us our lines, what to say and what to do. Diseased stories change us for the worse. Healthy stories tell us how to live. I want you to consider the following story. This is a story from the book John referred to, Letters to My Children, and I wrote many years ago when my children were quite small, relatively small, and my hope was, you know, if in fact I wasn't around, didn't live long enough to see my kids grow up, what could I leave behind that would be of some value besides my incredibly huge bank account as an English teacher? And I thought, something that would express values. How do I see the world? So they know something of their father. And what I found out was that every time I wanted to express a value, I told a story. And I had this time hadn't made the connection. But, you know, I'd say, well, you should be honest, or you should be thrifty, or wash behind your ears. And then a story would come to mind to tell them. And this is one of them. This is the format of the book is questions that my kids ask, followed by the answer. This one comes from Matthew, who is a member of Bethlehem and gets to hear John's 32-point sermons all the time. Here's Matthew's question. Papa, this nerd wants to sit next to me at school. Nobody likes him, and neither do I. What do you do when someone who's out of it wants to be your friend? And here's the answer. Dear Matthew, there are ways to be a friend to someone without being a bosom buddy. Even an occasional act of kindness can change the way a person feels about life. I'm thinking of Mary, a girl who was in my class once, but let me tell you the story. When I was in the sixth grade, I was an all-American. I was smart, athletic, witty, handsome, especially with a Vaseline wave of hair sweeping back from my forehead, and incredibly nice. I have photographic proof of that, by the way. Things went downhill fast in junior high, but for this one year at least, I had everything. It is really a pity when your life peaks in sixth grade. But it was a great year. Unfortunately, I also had Miss Owens for an assistant teacher. Miss Owens was a college girl who was practicing on us. She helped Mr. Jenkins, our teacher. Miss Owens also went to my church. She knew that even though I was smart and incredibly nice, there was a thing or two I could still work on. One of the things you were expected to do in grade school was learn to dance. My parents may have had some reservations at first, but since this was square dancing, it was okay. If you were raised fundamentalist, you know these little distinctions. Every time we went to work on our dancing, we did this terrible thing, and I mean it when I say it was terrible. I hope this kind of thing isn't done anymore. The boys would all line up at the door of our classroom. Then one at a time, each boy would pick a girl to be his partner. The girls all sat at their desk. As they were chosen, they left their desk and joined the snot-nosed kid who had honored them with his favor. Believe me, the boys did not like doing this. At least I didn't. But think about being one of those girls. Think about waiting to get picked. Think about seeing who was going to get picked before you. Think about worrying that you'd get picked by someone you couldn't stand. Think about worrying whether you were going to get picked at all. Think if you were Mary. Mary was a girl who sat up near the front on the right-hand side. She wasn't pretty. She wasn't real smart. She wasn't witty. She was nice, but that wasn't enough in those days. And Mary certainly wasn't athletic. In fact, she'd had polio or something when she was small. One of her arms was drawn up, and she had a bad leg. And to finish it off, she was kind of fat. Here's where Miss Owens comes in. Miss Owens took me aside one day and said, Dan, next time we have square dancing, I want you to choose Mary. She may as well have told me to fly to Mars. It was an idea that was so new and inconceivable that I could barely hold it in my head. You mean pick someone other than the best, the prettiest, most popular when my turn came? That seemed like breaking a law of nature or something. It was like purposely trading a Mickey Mantle card for an Andy Pafko. Who wants PAFCO when you can have Mantle? Who would pick Mary when there was Linda, Shelley, or even Doreen? And then Miss Owens did a really rotten thing. She told me it was what a Christian should do. I knew immediately I was doomed. I was doomed because I knew she was right. It was exactly the kind of thing Jesus would have done. I was surprised, in fact, that I hadn't seen it on a Sunday school flannel board yet. Jesus choosing the lame girl for the yeshiva dance. It was bound to be somewhere in the Bible. I agonized. Choosing Mary would go against all the coolness I had accumulated. It wasn't smart. It wasn't witty. Maybe it was nice, but even I didn't want to be that nice. The day came when we were to square dance again. Mr. Jenkins told Miss Owens to go up to the cafeteria to set up. Then he lined up the boys by the door. It was worse than you think. If God really loved me, I thought he will make me last in line. Then picking Mary will cause no stir. I will have done the right thing, and it won't have cost me anything. You can guess where I was instead. For whatever reason, Mr. Jenkins made me first in line. Had Miss Owens been talking to him? There I was, first in line, my heart pounding. Now I knew how some of the girls must have felt. The faces of the girls were turned toward me, some smiling. I looked at Mary and saw that she was only half turned to the back of the room, her face staring down at her desk. Mr. Jenkins said, "Okay, Dan, choose your partner." I remember feeling very far away. I heard my voice say, "I choose Mary." Never has reluctant virtue been so rewarded. I still see her face undimmed in my memory. She lifted her head, and on her face, reddened with pleasure and surprise and embarrassment, all at once was the most genuine look of delight and even pride that I have ever seen before or since. It was so pure that I had to look away because I knew I didn't deserve it. Mary came and took my arm as we had been instructed, and she walked beside me, bad leg and all, just like a princess. When we walked into the cafeteria, Miss Owens was already thumping out a march on the piano. She looked over at Mary and me, coming in at the head of the line, and she smiled real big, but with no surprise, like she knew all along. Linda and Shelley came up to me later, and in the catty kind of way said, "Miss Owens made you do that, didn't she?" I said no, and I wasn't lying. Miss Owens didn't make me do it. She had asked me to do it. She had told me I should, but I had chosen Mary, and I was glad. Mary is my age now. I never saw her after that year. I don't know what her life's been like or what she's doing, but I'd like to think she has a fond memory of at least one day in sixth grade. I know I do love Papa. Well, thanks. When I consider this story, I see that what motivated me to ask Mary to dance was a story motivation. Flavored with a little fundamentalist guilt. Miss Owens was worried about at least two things: the character, my own character, and the well-being of a young girl. She knew that this know-it-all 12-year-old boy needed to learn something about compassion, and she knew that this beaten-down 12-year-old girl needed a new way of seeing herself. And when Miss Owens said, "It's what a Christian should do," she was not appealing to a set of rules for Christians. Nowhere, Bible, anywhere else, is there a rule that says, ask lame girls to dance. She was appealing and reminding me of the Christian story. She was asking me to place my story next to that story, the Christian story, and see what the juxtaposition of the two might suggest. And that's exactly what happened. I didn't think of any specific commandments. There were none to think about. The Big Ten or otherwise. I thought of Bible stories, admittedly in a vague way. But I thought of Jesus' encounter with people in need. And I probably couldn't have told you any of those stories in detail, but I knew there were blind men and bleeding women and hungry families and crazy people. And I knew that in each case, Jesus did something for them. Sometimes pyrotechnically, sometimes secretly. So even as a self-absorbed 12-year-old boy, I was able to imagine, and I use that word advisedly, I was able to imagine what Jesus would likely do about a girl in his class with a bad leg when it came time to dance. And I knew it was something I didn't want I didn't want to do myself, but that I should. And that's where the guilt comes in. You know, being raised a good little fundamentalist, I was already well acquainted with guilt, and I was already growing impervious to it. But this felt different. If it was guilt, it was story guilt, not rule guilt. It said something like this: here's the story you are a part of. Here's what people in this story do, as we see in the Bible. What are you going to do? And I think I felt that finger pointing at me just as much as David felt Nathan's finger pointed at him when he says, "You are that man." You know. My adolescent mind had limited capacity for abstract moral calculation, but it was both wired and trained to understand story. Having imagined Jesus being in my story, in a portable classroom, sitting in a small coastal town in California, confronted with whether to choose Mary as a dance partner, I was unable to imagine him choosing anyone else. Not Linda, not Shelley, not even Doreen. My story gave me no realistic option than to do the right thing. I couldn't have done anything else and still been part of the story. I couldn't have done anything else and still been part of that story. One reason the story was so powerful was it addressed my emotions as well as my mind, and it still does. That story of Mary still affects me on all levels today. I could have constructed, I think, logical arguments for why I didn't have to do what Miss Owens asked, but I couldn't have convinced my emotions. If I'd gone just on reason, just on the intellect, I think I could have found counter reasons why I didn't have to do what Miss Owens wanted. But because that her appeal to me was to my whole person, there were parts of me that knew I could only do a single thing. I was very nervous when I said, "I choose Mary," maybe as nervous as I had ever been in my life, because my spirit knew that there was more at stake than my mind alone would have allowed. And I don't credit myself with realizing how much might have been at stake for Mary at that time. But I did dimly know how much was at stake for me. If I played it safe and chose someone else, I would create this gap between my story as church-going, Bible-reading kid on the one hand, and my actions in the real world on the other. That would have been harder to live with, that gap, than with the difficulty of saying, "I choose Mary," which was genuinely difficult. I didn't think of that dance for 25 years. I don't think I ever thought of that day from the day after on until I was trying to say something to kids of my own, until I was trying to answer this question from Matthew about what do you do when there's nothing in it for you in a relationship. But when I did think of the story, I knew it was one I had to tell. And this story illustrates a couple more things I'll only mention briefly. Number 7, stories are strong and complex enough to contain pain, suffering, failure, and mystery. Faith is well conceived of as a story because stories are strong and complex enough to contain pain, suffering, failure, and mystery. If you're faith story has no room for these things, it is not the biblical story of faith. The story of David and Bathsheba is a story of failure and suffering before it is a story of confession and forgiveness. Number 8, stories call us to action, and so does faith. Stories call us to action, and so does faith. Nothing kills a story faster than a passive protagonist. If a story is to engage us, the characters must act, even if they act disastrously. Likewise, passivity is the death of faith. Passivity is the death of faith. If you think faith is primarily a set of propositions to be agreed to, then you might well think it is enough to say, "Yes, I believe those things. Therefore, I'm a believer, a person of faith, I'm a Christian." If that was enough, then all the demons of hell would be creatures of faith. You'd be in good company. Because we are told that even the demons acknowledge the truth about God, and they tremble. James 2:9 says, "You believe that God is one? You do well." The demons also believe and shudder. Obviously, their belief that God is who he says he is does not make the demons creatures of faith. You and I are more likely to act in faith and live out the life of faith if we conceive of ourselves as characters in a story than if we think of faith as agreeing to a set of statements. When David heard the story that pointed out his failure, he knew he had to do something. He knew he could not say the same. The same was true for me when Miss Owens told me it was what a Christian should do, and that I should ask Mary to dance. I believe all of you have stories like the Mary story. These are signpost stories that we return to when we're trying to decide how to act in the world. And that gets me to my next point. Number 9, every human being needs not just stories. Each of us needs a master story. Each of us needs a master story. What is a master story? I got the term from a Jewish theologian, Michael Goldberg, who applied it to the Bible. He said the master story for Jews in the Old Testament is the Exodus story. That's the story that's repeated over and over again to tell them who they are. You are the people who God rescued out of Israel. And lots of things flow from that. And when they forgot that story, they forgot who they were. And they thought they were the same as the people around them. The master story for Christians, Goldberg rightly says, is the Easter story. It's the story of the cross and the resurrection that tells Christians who they are. And that's repeated, of course, throughout the New Testament. If we forget that story, we start to believe that we are like everyone else and that the only important thing in life is to be a good person. My street-level definition of a master story is as follows. A master story is one of a handful of stories that explains your life to you and tells you how to live. There are all kinds of things that flow out from this, but I'm going to try to just illustrate them in one more video clip. You're going to see a short clip. This is from a film called The Quarrel. The setting is Montreal in 1948. Two men accidentally or providentially meet who had been boyhood friends in Eastern Europe before World War II. They're both Jews. They had studied together in Eastern Europe, both to become rabbis. One lost his faith. He left the family, left the yeshiva, left his family and his town with great acrimony. And the other has become a rabbi and now has a yeshiva of his own. And they have met just serendipitously in this park after many years. Meanwhile, both of them have gone through the Holocaust. Both of them have lost their wives and children in the Holocaust and most of their extended family. And even though they're both Jews, I think we can see them as a microcosm of the culture wars. One, the secular hope in progress and making a better world through human effort. The other, a representative of faith and traditional values. And they collide together, much like we saw in that opening clip. They spend the day alternating, the afternoon, between tender reminiscences and terrible arguments because they are committed to different master stories. Just look at the clip. And that's exactly what he does. He tells him a story, and then the other fellow tells him a story, and they just keep telling stories back and forth all afternoon. Notice something here. They don't just tell stories. They think and they feel through their stories. Stories are not entertainment, they're not decoration, they're not illustrations, they are the raw material of thought and emotion, and they tell us how to live. These two men have had a collision of stories. And I think a lot of, as I said at the very beginning, a lot of what goes on in the world is collisions of stories. Northern Ireland, Protestant and Catholic, Middle East, Israeli and Palestinian, West versus East, collisions within stories, collisions within marriages with people with different master stories and different ways of understanding the world. And that story that we opened with, you know, that scene, that was a man in a bed dying with one story and this chaplain offering him her story, her master story, and him finding it totally inadequate to how he conceived of life, and so it erupts in anger and not understanding. That's a clip about colliding stories and our need for a story big enough to help us die. There are lots of categories of master stories, and I won't go into them, but there are political master stories. I mean, essentially this election are two people telling you a story about America, and you're deciding which story you like the better or which you find most believable. There are ideological master stories. There are historical master stories. I couldn't understand my grandparents until I understood something about the Depression and how they went through it. You can't understand George Bush without understanding 9/11. You can't understand Israeli politics without understanding the Holocaust and this idea of never again. And of course, there are personal master stories. You have master stories, both positive and negative, of achievements and failures, of broken marriages, of resolutions, of car accidents, of new births, of all kinds of things. But maybe the biggest category of master stories are religious. All religions are an attempt to be a master story, to answer life's big questions for you. And that, of course, is my I have many master stories, and the story of Mary is one of them, I think, for me now. But the central master story is the story of faith. It is a story that explains the world to me. It's a story that crystallizes my values, that helps me make decisions, that I return to in time of pain and trouble, that I'm willing to take risks for, all characteristics of master stories. I believe in the centrality of stories, but let me give you a warning about stories, especially about master stories. Not all stories are created equal. Not all stories are created equal. Stories can be healthy, and stories can be unhealthy. Master stories can give your life direction and meaning and hope, but master stories can also trap you in brokenness and despair. And even healthy stories, like the story of faith, can have unhealthy expressions, unhealthy traditions. A faith story can be marred by legalism or hypocrisy or abuse or anger. Remember, Satan is also a storyteller. Satan is the first literary critic. He takes the story of what's happened in the garden and he gives Eve a new interpretation of that story. So the world will tell you lying stories as well. And we have to be able to discern between them. The good news, however, is that no one has to remain in a broken story. No one has to remain in a broken story. No matter what your history, what your past, or your present, you can change your master story. Broken stories can be healed. New stories can be embraced. For time's sake, I'm just going to list without comment a few other things and then close. Number 10, stories create communities. That's another reason that stories are so apropos for faith. Number 11, stories make connect. Let me just simply say about that. One of the things that it means to be a believer, a person of faith, is that you share common stories. And one, you know, the most important collection of those common stories is the Bible. You become part of that family. You share those stories, which are more important than blood or DNA and those kinds of things. Number 11, stories make connections between seemingly disconnected things. That's why the brain loves story. That's what plot's all about. But we won't say anything more about that. Number 12, stories are the foundation for meaning and significance. Stories are the primary carrier of meaning and significance for human beings. Stories are God's and therefore humanity's most persistent vote that it matters that we are here. All right, so those are my 12 assertions about story and faith. I believe each of us needs a master story. So how do you know if your master story is a healthy one or an unhealthy one? Here's a partial list, and then I'll close with one more story. A master story must be truthful. It must be freeing and hopeful. It should be marked by action, by valuing of beauty, by respect for God's creation. It should be reflective, marked by grace and by a thirst for justice, and it must be a risk-taking story, all of which leads to my last story. This is a story about a young woman whose master story was the story of the gospel. A woman whose life displayed all the qualities of a healthy story that I've just mentioned. Her name is Rachel. I got to know Rachel when she joined a group of students that I took to Cuba to study writing in Hemingway and to get away from a Minnesota January. Here's a picture of Rachel on her wedding day. This is Rachel being serious. on her solemn day, and I use solemn in the medieval sense of both joyous and weighted with significance. Both joyous and weighted with significance. That's what a solemn occasion is, like a coronation or a wedding. The second photograph is Rachel, who, because she has a story to live by, can laugh extravagantly here with her new husband. This is a laugh you could get out of Rachel anytime. She could laugh like that because Rachel, and I use the word thoughtfully, enjoyed the hell out of life. There was no room for hell's lies and illusions in the way she lived. Rachel was incurably curious and passionate. She wrote excellent poems. She did everything she could to squeeze out all the juice of life. When she was a child, she was asked to identify something she was afraid of, and she wrote this: "As a child, I am afraid of having a mediocre life. I am afraid of having a mediocre life." And she lived so as to defeat mediocrity. She went twice to Spain and with us to Cuba, and she was game for any adventure, physical or intellectual or spiritual. She was passionate about poetry and friendship, and she soaked herself in Bible study and prayer with a kind of discipline that is rare among Christians of any time. Rachel actually thought it was possible to be godly. She actually thought it was possible to be godly, and that to live her life as though God were real, and she thought she should try. When she went to Spain the second time, she told her best friend they couldn't email each other, only write letters, because letters meant more. Can you imagine any young woman, any young person saying that today? No email, only letters. Her biggest fear in life was missing out on anything that life had to offer, especially missing something because she was afraid to fail or was passive or was indifferent. She had all the energy and passion and idealism of youth, and yet somehow it didn't seem naive. You got the feeling she had some wisdom about ultimate things that you did not, and it was your skepticism that was naive. From Spain, she wrote the following to her friend: "Remember, as far as I understand it, this world is not good versus evil, love versus hate. No, it's love versus nothing. So fight against nothing, the mass nada. Love against the lack of love. Hope, because there just might be a tomorrow. Hope brings into existence that which we want to be. Don't accept the pessimism. Recognize the problem. Hope in God, for I shall yet praise him." And Rachel knew about being a character in a story and about having her own actions shaped by Christ's actions. When we went to Cuba, I told them to bring little gifts to give to people that you might run into. Practical things like aspirin or writing pens or bars of soap. And when we were in a city in the eastern end of Cuba, Rachel was approached by a little boy about 4 or 5 years old who asked her in Spanish for money to buy some candy, he said. But she, because she had committed herself to learning Spanish and had planned next to learn German and Japanese, she was ready for the question. She got down on her knees so she looked the little niño in the eye and said to him in his own language, "I don't have any money, but how would you like this?" And she pulled from her bag a shiny new baseball. Now, this was a land in which we saw young people playing baseball with tree branches for a bat and tape in a wad for a ball. And this little kid was so amazed at his good fortune that he could not move. He was paralyzed by her generosity. It was a simple act of kindness, which is another quality of a healthy master story. I felt that kindness myself. Before we went to Cuba, Rachel was in one of my classes. And if you remember anything about school, you perhaps remember that teachers sometimes get the feeling that no one is listening, that no one is taking this stuff seriously, thinking that maybe you should have just taken that job in advertising after all. Sometimes it shows on our faces or in little cynical comments that we make in self-defense. Perhaps Rachel heard me say something or saw something on my face. At any rate, I found a handwritten poem on my door with no name on it. It ended something like this: "Speak on, O graybeard. Some of us are listening." Rachel sent me this poem anonymously as an encouragement. It was an act of kindness. How do I know it was from her? I found out at a memorial reading we had for Rachel at Bethel from her best friend Amber, who had helped her to write it. For you see, the photos from Rachel's wedding served double duty. They were also used on her funeral program a few months later. Rachel had been to a shower for her sister-in-law, had told her how thrilled she was to finally have a sister, and a few minutes after she left the shower, her car was hit by a truck, and she was sent suddenly into eternity. This last photo shows Rachel leaving us, and so she did. It is good that Rachel already had a master story to live by, because unbeknownst to her, unbeknownst to us, but not to her, it was chosen that her life was to be short. If Rachel had waited to find a story to live by, she would never have found one at all. Life is too precarious to live even a single day without a story. Rachel's life was brief, characterized by the qualities I have mentioned. Her life, her master story was true, it was freeing, it was full of beauty and respect for God's creation, it was gracious and hopeful and just and passionate and full of meaningful risks. It was a life worth living. And when I attended Rachel's funeral at Bethlehem, as I had done earlier for another student whose story is not unlike her own, I was deeply saddened. I wasn't interested in silver linings or in jumping too quickly into pious platitudes that too often have the effect of denying loss. I was sad for the unspeakable loss felt by her new husband and by her family who loved her so much and by those who called her best friend. And I felt sad for myself and others like me who knew her only well enough to admire her commitment to living fully. But this was my second funeral of a student at Bethlehem. And as I sat at Rachel's funeral, I thought of Joe's, a young man who died of AIDS and was full of faith and the acts of faith. Joe was sent off to heaven with a rock band and an audience that included people who did not look like they often went to church. As we sent off Rachel to heaven, I thought of Joe and I thought of the certainty that someday I will be the one in the casket in front of the church. How do I know that Joe and Rachel went to heaven? How do I know there is such a place as heaven? How do I know there's a God who awaits Joe and Rachel and you and me in heaven? Because my story tells me so. Other stories say it isn't true. It can't be true. You're free to choose those stories. I choose this one. I believe it is true or I wouldn't choose it. I am glad this is my story. It lets me go to my students' funerals and sing and clap my hands. May you and I live as characters in the story of faith with as much passion and purpose as Rachel. And let us thank God that he offers us such a story to live in. Let me close with prayer. Heavenly Father, we thank you that you are the creator of story, that you have asked us to be part of the greatest story ever told. Make that story so attractive and powerful to us that we want no other story in its place. We thank you for all that you have created. In Jesus' name, amen.